tape, if by chance you want to restrict anything in the tape, you can do on the second release. I got one.
Today is the 11th, 12th? 12th.
Today is the 12th.
Well. Okay.
Okay. Jack wants you to move just about an inch to your right. Does that work? Okay.
Okay.
Now, I'm going to, what I'm going to do is...
I don't need these.
Okay.
Not for vanity, it's just that I know with glare it's not good.
Oh.
It's not good, and I don't need them to see in any way of this range. I need them to read. I like to see. I can function without them.
Right.
I
good for
cataract
you.
Cataract surgery.
I'm getting more and more where I have to have mine on all the time.
Well, I leave them because I like to see things sharp in the distance, basically. Because I had cataract surgery, they give me two different visions in the eyes.
Mm-hmm.
So my middle vision is fine. This is beautiful.
Great.
This area.
Now, what happens is I'm just going to do a little speech, and I'm going to ask if you've agreed to be interviewed on the tape.
Mm-hmm.
And then this tape lasts 60 minutes. And when we're done with this tape, Jack will kind of tap me, and if you're in the middle of a story, we'll finish the story.
Mm-hmm.
And then we'll have the second tape. And if at any time you want to, I wanted you to have some water.
Oh, I have water. I think I'm fine.
Well, if you need to drink any water, of course, we don't have a good place.
I have cups, glasses back here.
I'll just put it there for you, if you feel like you want some.
Do you have?
I'm okay.
You're
right
sure?
Now. And so, but if you want to stop the tape or anything like that, we can just stop.
Okay.
And at the second tape, if you want to take a break. And Jack, do you want to take a restroom break or anything before? Okay. Here's my little cheat sheet here with some of your interests in it. It's going to make it
perfect.
You want
these pictures?
Well, I can hold on to them, and then we'll... When do you think it'd be a good time to introduce these, right? This is Rosalind Hinton interviewing Malka Lu at her home at 1302 Broadway in New Orleans, Louisiana. Today is Thursday, October 12, 2006. I am conducting the interview for the Katrina's Jewish Voices Project of the Jewish Women's Archive and the Goldring-Waldenberg Institute of Southern Jewish Life. Malka, do you agree to be interviewed and understand that the interview will be video recorded?
Yes.
I'd like to just start out with a little of your background as far as how you got to be here in New Orleans and when you came, mm-hmm. and a little bit about your family history here in New Orleans, mm-hmm. and also both your Jewish education here and your education in the school systems. Okay.
I was born in Houston. My mother was born in New Orleans. She moved to Houston when she married my father because this is when they want to stop. You may want to put this in. Hi, these are the kids from the day school coming to look at the sukkah. You want to put that in? It's part of it. I don't know. If you want or not.
Oh, that's
my granddaughter and classmates. I don't know. If you want that in there.
Well, are they going to be here for a little while?
Let me check this.
Tour Academy?
The Tour Academy.
Tour Academy.
Right.
Okay. We can just wait a few minutes and let them... We'd have to break it down and start over again. I think we can begin again with you just talking about where you were born and how you came to be in New Orleans and a little about your family here in New Orleans.
My mother grew up in New Orleans, and when she married my father, she moved to Houston. We were in Houston until that was 41. I was born in 43. The day after I was 7, she had a stroke. The baby, my brother was 18 months old. There were 2 in between. Then I had an older sister. Mother had it from a previous marriage, who was in college in Alabama. And because of the severity of her stroke, it was her complete left side, and there was no therapy, no treatment at that time in 1950, her family bought a home here. Her father bought a house here for us to come back to New Orleans so she could get more help. Mm-hmm. So we moved back here. So this is basically where I grew up.
And you grew up not in an area that was typical of the Jewish community, as Broadmoor. You grew up...
We grew up near Napoleon Magazine in that area.
Mm-hmm.
I went to a public school, McDonough No. 7, which was... We were usually the only Jewish children there. So I think sometimes there may be some others once or twice, once in a while. And then I went to McMaine Junior High School, which was most of the Jewish children went there as a public. That was the public high school that most of the Jewish children went to. If they didn't go to one of the private schools, a few of them at that time, there were a few other public schools that the children went to. And Forche was like the high school that it fed into. I went to Benjamin Franklin School for first year of high school, not 10th, 9th grade. I forgot, whatever it was. Yeah, the freshman year. No, freshman since you got it.
Well, that's okay. And, don't worry about
I went there, details. And I only went there for 1 year, and then the next 2 years I went to Forche. I finished at Forche, and then I went to Newcomb.
Mm-hmm. And you went to Newcomb College.
Right.
And what was it like to be Jewish in New Orleans in the 40s and 50s when you were growing up?
It was a beautiful life. We belonged to Beth Israel. My grandfather had been one of the founders and supporters of it. He was very active there. And it was really a beautiful, warm community. There were a lot of families, a lot of big families at that time. Of course, you know, post-World War, there was a baby boom, so a lot of kids. We knew kids from different areas. At that time, the community was in transition, moving from one area to the city. You know, as people became more prosperous, they were moving up. They were moving out of the old neighborhoods into the uptown area, into Broadmoor, and then later on further out, different areas. We went to Beth Israel Sunday School. It was afternoon Hebrew school, which was twice a week until early teens. And it was a nice warm thing. We had big families here, a lot of friends.
Tell me a little about, because you said your sister was 1 of 7, so you actually...
My mother was 1 of 7.
Your mother, I'm sorry.
Yes.
And so you had a lot of family here in New Orleans.
Right.
And just some of the businesses your family was in that you were telling me about earlier, I found very interesting.
My grandfather had come as an immigrant from Hungary into Pennsylvania with his family as a young boy, and he was the eldest. He left home to help as a boy to help support the family, and he wound up in New Orleans in this area. He started out buying feathers of quilts from farms and pick up a chair. He got a wagon and a horse and picked up chairs here and there. So this here, that there. And there were relatives in Nashville. And this is where he met my grandmother. She had come over as a teenage girl. Cousins brought her over. supposed to help her learn English, and somehow they were introduced, they got married, and then they moved to New Orleans. And at that time, the antique business, he was one of the ones in the beginning of the antique business, they were like he was, use furniture, pick up here, there, in the street, or whatever, from people selling stuff, much as I guess the flea markets do now here, and or they were pawn brokers, and people were selling off furniture, and he was very good with languages, he was very intelligent, he educated himself, he became one of the primary early antique dealers here. Feldman was well known for importing fine European furniture. And my mother was the youngest of seven children. When she was born in 1910, they were still living above the shop, as they say, on Royal Street. He had several shops there, several properties. He had what was called, in the family they called it the factory. He was a big build place down there where they employed all sorts of marble workers and cabinet makers and upholsterers from Germany. There were Italians, there were Creoles, there were all sorts of tradespeople like this, this kind of craftspeople. It was a big operation. They made furniture, they restored, so it was a big industry here at one time.
And so he hired these different kinds of people.
He had these different kind of people to do this work.
Mm-hmm.
There was oil money in Texas and Oklahoma. There was wide open gambling here in New Orleans, which attracted people with money. So these early antique dealers did very well, as well, because people, but locally, the plantations were selling off. People here were selling furniture, but also in Europe, there were depressions. People were selling off castles. They would go over there and buy a whole castle full of furniture, a whole estate, a manor, or whatever. A lot of furniture, a lot of things, artifacts,
And so tell me a little about also your husband's name?
Morris.
Morris, and I just found his business fascinating too.
He came here as a teenager. His mother's father died young in Europe from tuberculosis and left the grandmother with several young children. Some of the older ones had already been married, and his father and mother married in Europe and went to Argentina. Because the grandfather had cousins here in New Orleans, who were already in New Orleans, and were helping them to come over, and that was before World War II broke out. And then the war broke out, his parents got stuck in Argentina. They went to Argentina first because that's where they could get immigrate to before they weren't able to get into America.
Right.
This was
right.
In the 30s, early 30s, I guess. And when the war broke out, they had papers, they were ready to come to America and had to wait until after the war. So he came here as a teenager, and he worked for a relative of a relative in a business that specialized in dry goods, selling to basically the seamen. The ships used to come in for a week or so. There were 30 or 40 seamen. They sold to them. They sold to the longshoremen, because it was close to the riverfront on Canal Street. And from that, he went into wholesale retail, selling cosmetics and blue jeans. A lot of blue jeans became very popular in other parts of the country. And when his brothers came out of the service,
now you said
as
they
we
sold.
Got married, we were married in 1964. He became a partner, and we eventually bought out the original owner of the store, Mr. Alec Tressman, who had become like a father to my husband, very, very kind gentleman. And then we set up the younger brother eventually took over this business, the clothing type stuff and cosmetics. His other brother we put cigarette and liquor in bond to the seamen, to the ships, and he opened up electronics business. Specialized 220 electronics and appliances. And that became, the appliances were good, but what happened with the smaller appliances and electronics is that the manufacturers began making them with a switch that it could be 110 or 220, so you didn't need these things. And originally things like Toshiba and Panasonic and Sony, these kind of things, sound equipment, and all sorts of cameras. They could buy anywhere. They didn't need a special thing for this, special place to buy. So he went into general ship's handling, which is ship supplies, to supply anything we needed for the ships. We had a building we had gotten as a warehouse, and set an office in there and use the warehouse to buy stuff as he needed, and special order things, anything they needed, from toothpicks to cranes for the ship. It did very well until he closed.
So it's a bit of a story that happens in a port city.
Right, right. New Orleans port, what happened when roll-on roll-off came along, which was invented by a Jewish, was developed by a Jewish architect here, Goldman, I think his name, I can't remember, that cut the shipping industry down tremendously. They didn't need as many longshoremen. There were smaller crews, very small crews on the ship. They didn't need so many people to handle the stuff. And the ships were able to make a fast turnaround.
So it cut down on the kind of businesses that would service the ships.
Right, right, right. It's still a big port area. The people don't realize the port of Louisiana, of New Orleans, basically goes, well, until Katrina, was almost the mouth of the river. We hear Port Fouchon, which was just basically destroyed, which is the mouth of the river, all the way up by to Baton Rouge area, because that's a chemical area, and then in between you have where they load the grain, get grain, and it is all really one port. It's different ports and different authorities, but this is where the Mississippi River, and this is what we serviced, all this area and down into the Gulf Coast and into Houston. Sometimes the ships went, he traveled all over into Florida, into Houston.
So let's go back a little bit, and I'm just curious about your experiences at Newcomb. What did you take at Newcomb? And
I was a political science major. I took it. I had no idea what it was. I had never heard of it before. I was extremely naive. I thought I would go to school and major in English, but I didn't want to teach because this was a little pre-feminist movement. But I didn't want to get out of school and say, what do you want to teach, or how fast can you type, and be at the same level as people who had gone to not as rigorous training or had not gone to college at all, not for teaching, but for secretarial type work. Because the idea was, at that time, was, you know, you get a job, unless you're terribly talented or driven for some reason, you get a job that you can support yourself with until you get married or maybe go back to later when your children are born, you know, or older. It was just it wasn't career oriented as it is now. And I don't think it was for most of the boys either. They just got a liberal arts degree, just like people get a business degree today. Along the way, I got married and continued. I graduated from school. And that was
You continued school and finished, even though you were married?
Yeah. Yeah, it was odd to get married at that time. I got married along the way while I was still in school. And the only reason I took political science, I got a card that I was qualified to take this freshman class. I hadn't heard of it. I didn't know that. I wasn't sure the difference between Republican and Democrat. I said, well, maybe I'll go. It's interesting. I still don't know the difference between Republican and Democrat, and I don't think they do either anymore.
It's for different reasons.
And then when my children were young,
Tell me how many children you have.
I have two boys, and they were born in 1970 and 73. And in the early 80s, because the younger was born in 73, and he was about almost three. When I went back to UNO to take classes, I decided I was going to go to med school. So I finished a pre-med. When I started, I had a woman working for me who was excellent. I had my mother who was able to help. It was the days before daycare. And things disintegrated. My mother was more and more unable to help. The woman who was working for me had to stop working. I had other people helping, but things just tapered out. And several things happened with the child care, with the kids, and after a few years, I was ready to go. I took exams, I was invited to Tulane. what's called Second Stage, where they invite you to come in for interviews. I had the papers for that filled out, ready to send in, and I tore them up because of incidents that happened. The kids weren't being watched properly. I just decided it wasn't worth it.
So what kind of decisions did you make about your kids? Where were they at school and such as that in their education?
The older one went to Beth Israel Nursery for a year, and then at the urging of our dentist, who really was very big on a boys' school that was here, Sam Barth, urged us to put him in there, which we did. They went from three-year-olds through high school.
What school was it?
Sam Barth. It was a boys' school. And I was very pleased with it. I was in school at the time, and or started a school around then, and I intended to send them to the day school that opened in 1970, the Hebrew Day School here at Lakeshore. But I was so happy with this other school, and in the other school, the day school had problems, they kept changing faculty and different, you know, and I just left. I said, well, we'll just keep him here. And then he was there. Perry, the young one, Perry, started there as a three-year-old, and Alex was there through second grade. That summer, we made a decision. The Rabbi Beth Israel, Rabbi Bienfeld, came and spoke with us, and we had no valid reason for not sending them to today's school, really. There was no reason not to, other than we were happy where they were. So he talked to us, and you know, we agreed to send him to the day school, which we did. From that point on,
you're still connected to the day school.
Well, that school closed. The that is no more. And now we have they had already graduated by the time it closed down. And now there's the Hebrew New Orleans Jewish Day School Federation sponsored, and then there's my grandchildren go to Torah Academy, so mm-hmm. There are two Jewish day schools here now.
What do you think of the New Orleans Jewish community? How do you perceive it as and its relationship to the larger city and such as that?
Well, I think in early days. Historically, the early Jews who came here did get into the community. They were merchants and craftspeople, whatever. And a lot of them were a lot of single young men who came over, who married, they went into small communities. And a lot of, in the Gold, you find out this all of the South, there was some intermarriage, or there was Jews who were in small communities that eventually died, the communities died out because people went away to bigger communities. And I'm saying here in New Orleans, I know that when my mother was growing up, there wasn't a tremendous separation early, but there was a lack of social interaction between the very reformed and the very new coming Eastern European immigrants. The more orthodox. There was not a lot of contact at one time between them. And there were different, and then eventually it got to the point, I know when I was in high school, everybody went out, yeah, we were friends with everybody, this didn't seem to be a big factor. But I know for a while historically it was. And then it seemed that people began to integrate, into assimilate more into the community. There was a whole movement, not just with the Jewish people, but all ethnic movements to become American, but this big melting pot movement. So what do you call the social halls? Settlement house movements. Mm-hmm. You know, they came out. No one could speak their native languages. They had to have American names. They had to look like Americans. And this hurt the Jewish community, I think, extremely.
Mm-hmm.
I really.
You think the Jewish community
of my mother's generation,
of your mother's generation,
because a lot of what was taught and lived at home was seen as old-fashioned. What was seen lived in Europe, or even if they were religious here, it was seen as old-fashioned.
Well, how about with your generation?
My generation was pretty American. It was not really, I mean, people kept Sabbath, my age were, I don't know, I don't remember anybody who really did.
Did your family?
No, well, there were funny kind of things, like we had to be at candlelight, when Mother lit candles on Friday night, we had to be at the table when my father said Kiddush, and, but then we would go out. I know my mother would fuss at us if we did certain things on Sabbath, like write or use scissors or things like that. You shouldn't be doing it, but we did it. We should sew, don't sew. It's, you know, Shabbos, you shouldn't be doing that. But these things weren't kept at home. My father went to work. And, there was an idea, there was a big pressure. You have to work 6-7 days a week. You know, you have this. But a lot of the businesses that people were in, people came here to America, and if, you know, if you don't work on Saturday, you don't work. I know many people that I've heard over the years, you know, the father, the grandfather would have one job one week, one job the next week. And it was hard to keep up. It was hard. It was a lot of pressure, economic pressure and social pressure, I think, on families. But by the time we came along, it was just social.
What is the center now of your Jewish community for you today?
For me today, for our family, it's Chabad. We were at Beth Israel. I was very reluctant to leave. Beth Israel was a big, at one time, the biggest synagogue here was Orthodox. It was very, but it wasn't practicing. It didn't support people. There was no support of people really who practiced fully. Not for children. It was not because everybody was doing American things.
So tell me what you mean when you say practice fully.
Practice fully means to keep the laws of Sabbath, to keep the laws of kosher, to keep the laws of, it should be kept. It's supposed to be. It was very difficult. Extremely difficult. When I began going to shul on Saturday, in the mornings, I was one of the younger people there, and I already had children. I mean, I was in my mid-30s. There were a few of us 30 to 50, and everybody else was older, 60, 70, 80 years old. You know, parents and grandparents of my friends.
Did you live near Beth Israel so you could walk?
We moved there when in 1971, when our oldest son was a year old. Yeah, we wanted to walk. This was before we were religious. When I got married, I thought that when I got married, I would keep kosher, I would make Sabbath and all that. But because of the clientele we had, my husband said he didn't know when we would come home, when we could eat, where we had to go out and eat, whatever. We didn't do it.
Can you attribute anything to why? I mean, you're wanting to do this is a little different than your friends and neighbors.
Well, a lot
captured
of,
you, your interest in...
A lot of friends that I grew up with did keep, in the older generation than myself, a lot of them, until the men went away to World War II or to Korea. They went away and, you know, things were lenient. They became more lenient. They didn't keep the way their parents did. I remember a mother of a friend of mine being asked, why did you stop keeping kosher? And she explained that it was the days the husbands were away at war. They had little children. It was hard to get to where the kosher meat markets were. Maybe they lived in different, they moved to different, but whatever, I don't know. It was difficult, and the meat would be delivered if you weren't home. You had to, you know, they'd just deliver it on the route. And people stopped doing it. A lot of people would keep kosher in the home. They'd make the holidays, but they didn't observe the laws fully. And they would eat out, or they'd eat out like maybe not that the food wasn't kosher as far as the meat, but they would order fish or salads.
What made you go back to this?
I think I always wanted to as a child. Always did. I enjoyed it. I knew about it. I said I was always from means religious observant. In my heart, I just didn't do a lot about it. I'm not sure a lot of things changed along the way. I had a friend who had become religious, and I used to go visit her on Sabbath, on Shabbos afternoon on Saturday, and visit with her a lot. And she was instrumental in starting a bookstore at Chabad House here. And she asked me to come help out with the bookstore. I started doing that. I became friendly with Boomer Rifkin. Our boys were in school together. We sent the boys to the day school. And I knew, you know, to send them to the day school, we wanted to not send them to school and give them a different message. Although my husband still was eating out and still was not as observant as I was. The observance came slowly and in steps. We'd do this, then that, then the next step. With kosher, with the Sabbath, whatever, and just in steps. But through Chabad, I became more and more disillusioned with Beth Israel, where we were. Our oldest son, when he went away to school, went to a yeshiva for a little while. It didn't work out. It wasn't the right place for him. Then he went to a high school in New York, and it was Lubavitch. And when he came home, he wanted to pray Lubavitch way, when we would come uptown and stay with friends in this area, and particular holidays. Then I began going to the Jewish women's, the Lubavitch conventions and different events. And I just found this was a Hasidic way of life is what I wanted. It was right. It seemed the best way for me, or for anyone really. Is very, people think Hasidic are all, yeah, da 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 da, joy, 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 foolishness. But it's not this foolish, not foolish, but this fun, joyous aspect, which joy is a very big part of it. But it's very intellectual also. And that appealed to me. And meeting the Lubavitch Rebbe, really. Over the years, seeing that all kind of people, it wasn't just one type of person. I thought when we sent the kids, one reason we didn't want to send them to day school originally, because we had such a cosmopolitan group of people through business that we were social with, from all walks of life, from all over the world, that everybody would be the same, narrow way, and it wasn't a narrow way of life at all. I found it was that the women, Jewish women, are very powerful, not subservient is the way depicted. There was a journalist, Liz Harris, the New York Times, who wrote a book. She did a series of interviews with a family in Crown Heights, and she realized, you know, she used the expression, not all chained to the chicken pot, soup pot. And running barefoot and having children. Lubavitch women, I found, were very well respected within the community. The Lubavitch Rebbe particularly promoted the women. He gave a lot of respect to them. Very, very, I met some extremely intelligent women, very learned. It was just very, very personal to me and touched. The first convention that I went to was a year after the Rebbe's and the Rebbe's wife had passed away, and I just was impressed. I saw people said, you know, you're going to New York, you have to get special clothes, you got to dress nicely in fashion. I said, no. I realized there, you could see women in the latest designer clothes, the most expensive things you can imagine, down to people who would bargain thrift shop clothes from their friends to come. And from all walks of life, and everyone's the same. Everyone's treated the same and respected the same, and I think this really appealed to me.
Well, I appreciate you kind of establishing who you are before we get into the Katrina story, and I feel you've done a beautiful job with that. And so I think that kind of sets the stage, though, to kind of say, now let's look at Katrina and tell me, you know, when you first realized you had to do something about Katrina, when you were first thinking about it?
Well, we checked the news, of course, and right before Sabbath came in, before everything was fine, it was going towards the east. It wasn't coming this way at all. Just like Betsy, it changed overnight. So Saturday, Shabbos, I didn't go. I couldn't go out. I was still on a gastric tube. I had had surgery.
Oh, explain that.
Oh, let's back
that
up
might
a little.
Be an important.
Let's back up to that one. I had a cancer in my jaw bone, which was diagnosed in the beginning of the summer, end of May, beginning of June, and I had gone to the hospital for surgery on July 27th to have that, and I had just been home for a week and a half. The only outings I had gone was to the doctor. I think once I ran out of the car to run into Walgreens to pick up a prescription. But I was basically sitting because I had this tube and I had to keep pouring the food in four times a day and the medicine and the liquids and everything went through the tube. It was pretty time consuming. And I had just begun to move around the house a little, to do a few loads of laundry, to maybe run the dishwasher. Then after the grandchildren were over to visit, I didn't go out that day. I was sick. My stomach was very bad from medication I was taking. And as soon as Sabbath was over, I put on the machine to check the news because somebody said they fear that the hurricane may be coming this way. That was a rumor in Shul that day. And we didn't know. We had looked out, Newcomb students, the Tulane students were all over the place. And when I looked out in the afternoon, and they hadn't left. I said, saw the cars. I said, we'll see what happens after. And my husband went to take the grandchildren. Well, I had to call in the doctor because of stomach troubles, and they changed my prescription. He took the grandchildren who were here playing home, and he went to Walgreens to get medicine. And by the time he came back, I said, we got to go. Got to pack up and go. He said, nah, it's not that I'm going to sleep. The medicine's not going to be. They told me to come back in 4 hours. This was at 10 o'clock. He said, I'll go get your medicine in the morning. Don't worry about it. He had his truck basically loaded. He had some things to pick up. He had to make a delivery to Houston that day, that Sunday. He was going to bring stuff to a ship. He had some stuff, and he had to go pick up the provisions, the food stuffs, at the wholesalers Sunday morning. So I kept listening to the news and checking things and back and forth with my daughter-in-law. And we said we'd have to go. So I would pack a little bit of stuff, not knowing what I was packing, what I was doing, throwing stuff in the laundry, making sure we had a couple of clothes. Because my fear was that the hurricane hits, you're without electricity, you're without water, you can't do laundry, you can't. So I figured I'll do enough laundry for the week and make the towels and things that need to be done. And decided pack a little bit of food. I had all my medicines, get all the medicines. Okay, what should we take in case, because keeping kosher, after our experience, we left for Ivan. We knew you need food on the road. You need food where you're going. You don't know where you'll be stuck or what. And my husband went to bed in the meantime, thinking that, you know, he would go to Houston in the morning, but no, don't worry about it. It's not going to be so bad. So I kept doing all this stuff, making preparations, and I said, is that we spoke to the neighbor? And he said he was staying also. And then in the morning, he said, no, I'm leaving. So we told him we were leaving. He said, yeah, he's leaving also. That was what happened. We thought we would be back in a few days. We took, two denim skirts. I convinced my husband we should take a change of clothes. But we went, looked like the Beverly Hillbillies, because he already had the truck. They had put a tarpaulin over. I had a little small carry-on bag. In the truck, I had to put a cooler bag like this with food. So I'm sitting like this because I had all my stuff at my feet. We had to take a box with my liquid food. I had to take some clothes, medicines. I had some huge plastic syringes to feet. It's fun going down the road doing this, feeding yourself through the tube. Mm. And this was a horrendous trip. It wasn't as bad as I, because it wasn't as long. We wound up in a motel. My daughter-in-law's brother went on the internet and found a place for us to stay. They'd left about an hour before us with the kids. They get to where they're there, and the manager has no idea what's going on. Priceline or Expedia, whatever one of these, whatever one of these
Expedia, one of these online.
Well, whoever had made the arrangements through didn't connect with the motel properly. So there's no place. So we happened to find a place that had two rooms. And it was on the way on the northwest side of Houston, way northwest of Houston area, industrial kind of area. It was a funny area. And we were there for a couple of days. And while we were there, my daughter-in-law's grandmother realizes she has a niece who has a cousin, some one of these kind of relatives, who has a house near an Orthodox synagogue that they only use it for Sabbath. They, in the holidays, maybe they would let us use their house. So they made the contact and they said, sure, go ahead, use the house. So the end of the week, we were able to get in there. And they said, after Levy spoke, he said, you know, just stay as long as you want. So it was really nice. We had a house. We were there. My son and his three children, his wife were there. Everything was set up. The synagogue was within walking distance. It
was
grocery.
And what was the synagogue?
United Orthodox Synagogue.
Mm-hmm.
And then Chabad was able to make arrangements at a apartment complex near the Chabad Center, with the school and the synagogue. And they were able to get apartments for the families there, so we moved into that after about 2 weeks. But in the meantime, it was beautiful. The Chabad community made meals for us, sent dinner over every night.
This was the Houston Chabad community.
Chabad sent us every night. We had dinner, a hot dinner.
How did you find people, the rest of your community, and who were you looking for that
We knew that the two the Rabbi Nemes was stuck in Metairie,
mm-hmm.
and we knew that our Rabbi Rifkin was here, had not left, because there were people with them, their children and whatever, their families were still here. They didn't get out in time after the blood. Because you think the levees aren't going to, you know, who knew the levees were going to break? This was a big problem, was when the flooding came in. They were able to get out. The Rifkin gang was able, the whole, with their two sons and families, were able to get out. Nemesis got out a little bit later. They went to Metairie. They had a whole horrendous storm. But after the levees broke and realized, you know, this is who knows how long. And Rifkin was able to came in, and they were able to make these arrangements. So the end of that week is when we went into these apartments. The apartments were totally fresh. It was a shock to walk in. They put beds, tables, how many people, you didn't have any chairs, sofas, everything. Pantry, fully stocked pantry. There had been a kosher food drive, apparently. I don't know how much came from the food drive, how much I understand the Chabad community, the other communities. What was donated, I can't tell you. I don't know. We had linens for the beds. We had towels. We had food. There was a little set of pots and pans. Everything was ready. The kitchens were made kosher. We could use. We just had to move in. It was just so overwhelming. The kids, the grandchildren had already begun the school there. Well, the schools all over opened up to everyone. It was beautiful. I mean, all the schools, that was all over the South, wherever people went. The commute from where we were originally to the school was very difficult. My husband said, you know, let's go, this is nice to have this house, but let's go to these apartments. It'll be easier on her with the kids, because it's just basically across the street, a block or two away. She doesn't make this commute. So it was nice. It was fun because I don't like apartment living, I found out. I just don't, not, but it was nice because the grandchildren, we had the three children there, and we were there for a long time, watched a little one grow, you know, when you go with a toddler who learns to walk and starts talking, and my little grandson learned to whistle, the middle one, he was seven, which is neat. Would have, in the morning, this little, I'm an early riser, so I had this little, on the door, 6:30, something like that. It would be my granddaughter coming to have breakfast with us. And a little bit later, the other ones would come. And they ran back and forth. And because it was, we were like at the back this way, in a parking area. And they were in another set. They were like across them for the next group of apartments. All the kids played in that parking area because it was a safe area. People usually didn't come a lot. So there were our grandchildren, there were other children there from the community. And there were some children who lived there anyway, some families. And they all played together outside. They were in and out of the apartment and in and out of our place and their places. And it was just nice. We had an open house kind of thing.
Well, did Rabbi Rivkin or Blumen get in touch with you, or did you find them, or how did you find out about the apartment?
I think we had been in touch I don't remember. I know that when they came to town, when they got to Houston, I went with my daughter-in-law that afternoon when she picked up the kids to go see Bluma.
Mm-hmm.
You know, it was a few days after when did they come? I think the levees broke and they were able to get out that day, that Tuesday, I think it was. They were able to get out.
Mm-hmm.
So, when the flooding started. So, I saw it right away.
So tell me, how did it feel to be on the receiving end?
Very difficult. Very, very difficult. It's the only way I can explain it. I have a friend who went to another community. She said it was funny. They were sitting around one day. It shows that was a group from New Orleans. Said, here we were, people, there were a lot of professionals, doctors, teachers, or whatever, you know, business people. And we're talking about getting food stamps and going to the Red Cross and this kind of thing. And it's unusual, but you come to terms with it because in our case, and for most people, you didn't know what was going to be financially. You really didn't know. You couldn't contact the finance unless you had with a national institution. We had dealt with local banks. We dealt here with Whitney and Hibernia. You couldn't have access to information. You didn't have access to your accounts. You didn't know what was going. You didn't know what bills you were going to have to pay. I mean, if you had your number, if you thought enough to have your credit card numbers and your account numbers or whatever with you, you could make contact. But the thought was so overwhelming at first until we knew what was happening. You have to pay a mortgage and you have to pay a rent. You have to pay your light and gas at home. You're going to have to pay utilities wherever you are somewhere else. It's a big burden, not knowing what kind of repairs you're facing, what the insurance companies are going to do. It was just an overwhelming lack of information and knowledge, really. Whitney Bank that we dealt with, you'd go to these banks and the lines would be long, long hours, an hour or so to see an office, an hour or so to make a deposit, get your money, whatever. It was just very difficult. And who wants to live on credit forever? You know, I mean, how long can you do it?
Mm-hmm.
I mean, I think most people, even if you were okay financially, it's the lack of knowledge of what's going to be. And we see the flood waters coming in, not knowing when you'd get back home. What do you do in between? Do you have a job? Don't have a job? You have a business, you don't have a business. Who knows? You can't contact people. There was no phones. Most people grabbed their cell phones. Cell phones, you know how long they lasted. On the road, they started going out already. Mm-hmm. The cell phone system was horrible.
So you had the added problem of being ill.
Yeah. Yeah. I had appointments that week. I was to go Monday to the doctor, and he was setting up appointments for me to take a swallow test to see if I could have the gastric tube removed, if I was able to swallow enough. And because I had stitches that were inflamed here, I was going to see an infectious disease doctor. I had a small opening here under my jaw. It had originally been all the way through from the surgery. It had to be changed twice a day. I originally had a home nurse coming, had to put gauze in there, and I was wrapped around with this stuff called Curlex to keep it in place. Also, and you had to put on gloves. There was a whole rigmarole to clean it out. I was also going through that. So it was, I had an appointment on Monday with my doctor and with and I had an appointment set with the infectious disease doctor. I had an appointment to get the swallow test to see if the tube could be removed. In the meantime, because of antibiotic problems, was giving me stomach problems when we left, I figured, all right, we'll get to Houston. We'll get in the morning, we'll go pick up the prescription in the morning before we leave. When we went in the morning, Walgreens was already closed here. And we got to Houston, Sunday night, we were just so exhausted, forget it. Monday morning we went and to Walgreens, they couldn't give me the prescription, they didn't have the whatever, you know, the records between one place and the other. Showed that we had, the prescription was in New Orleans, we had picked it up, but we hadn't. So I said, I've got to get my husband, I have some business to attend to, so my son and his family went. I said, let's just go to the medical area and go to an ER. I was fortunate, I went to Texas Methodist Hospital, into the ER. I told him, I said, look, I've got this flare up. I look like a teenager here. It was always big things. I have to see an infectious disease doctor tomorrow. They gave me they put me on antibiotics. They made an appointment. They told me who to call in the morning. I was able to go in the morning to see the infectious disease doctor, who said, look, you don't know what's going on. They told him, I'm not going to, this is off the books. I'm sending you to a plastic surgeon to check this out. So who was able to see me there, that right after that, who opened it and took cultures and come back Friday. So to make a long story short, I saw those doctors. I told them along the way I had to take the swallow test. I have to see a head and neck oncologist, who I did. And by that time, you're able to swallow your saliva? I said, yeah. So she gave me a little water. I was able to swallow the water. Fine, you can take the tube out. She made arrangements for me to get the tube out. We did that. All this in Houston in a matter of like 2 weeks. I've been back and forth with cultures. And one of the beautiful experiences we had in Houston was that I had to go for some cultures at the hospital. And my husband had run out of one of his medications. And they told him, go to this clinic there and they'll take care of it. They said, no, you have to go through the ER. We went down into the ER to see about his prescriptions, and this was when the first busload of people was coming from the dome. Horrendous, just horrendous, and so sad. Mostly old people. And the staff there was just so beautiful and so accommodating. Young woman, a nurse, whatever, she took us, because it's a whole maze to go through to find from one section of the hospital to the other, took us through in the long shot. Doctors had taken his vitals. By the time they gave us his prescriptions, a woman comes out with a list like this. Here are your prescriptions. Do you need help in getting these filled? He says, what do you mean? Take the drugs. He says, no, follow me. Took us to a huge auditorium. There was a table, must have been 12 feet of table along the whole wall, 14 feet. Filled with huge bowls with fruit. There were those little hospital, you know, the jellos and jellies. There were drinks. There were urns with coffee, with tea, with hot water, cold drinks, sandwiches, crackers.
The hospital did that?
Yes, the hospital did this. They had this whole thing set, room set up with chairs. There were tables with social workers to take care of people. There were ministers. There was one man, so I was sitting in a room with her head down, I don't know for how many hours, how long, while we waited for the prescriptions to be filled. You saw the people coming in wrapped in blankets, whatever kind of clothing they could give them, scrubs, whatever, waiting for family members. The families from St. Bernard told us what happened there, different things. The food was amazing, the way they treated. Then when they finally bring the prescriptions, rather than how much do I owe you? And one of them says, oh, don't worry, it'll be taken care of somehow. We'll get reimbursed for it. And do you need transportation home? Do you need help with transportation?
Oh my God.
And this is how they work. In every doctor's office we went to, they were just so accommodating. One place a woman came out behind the desk and gave us a hug just because we were Katrina victims or whatever. It was just amazing. You'd go in the stores in Houston and people would, you know, just so concerned. Of course, after a while, things died out. I mean, I think we all wore out our welcome after, you know, the first month or so. But it was just really beautiful. And the outpouring of love from all over the country, all over the world. We received gift cards, were given, money was given, and gift cards were given out to different places. We are from my community, I don't know who else got, if it was to Kubat or what, we were given gift cards to a place called Sims, which is not here, it's another place, discount clothes, like, it's like TJ Maxx or one of these Marshalls, one of these kind of, but they have a lot of upscale clothes, all sorts of stuff, that people were able to get clothes for the holidays, because Rosh Hashanah and Yom Kippur were coming, and we were obviously stuck there. It was just an amazing, amazing setup.
What was Yom Kippur, Rosh Hashanah and Yom Kippur like?
We were fortunate that somebody made arrangements to send a whole truckload of food. There were contacts we made because there was a student at Tulane who had family in Monroe, Louisiana, who had a hotel. We were able to get the Chabad community, whoever else wanted, would evacuate to different places together in Monroe, which was centrally located. We came, busload came from Houston, a busload came from Memphis. People drove in from Alexandria and New Orleans, and I don't know where else. Bloomer Rifkin can give you more details on that. The most lavish setup of food you can imagine. Breakfast, lunch, dinner, everything was catered. And these two young boys took from New York, two young men came in with the truck. A woman from here who works for Bloomer Rifkin was able to come in and help with the cooking and make sure that everything was kosher, because there was no kosher kitchen in the hotel. They had to make facilities, and
Okay, well, we're going to stop right now, and we're going to continue.